Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, we will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
The button. This meeting is being live streamed. It is 10:30 a.m. on the West Coast, 1:30 p.m. on the East Coast. No idea what that is, Australian Eastern Standard Time. I think this is the time of the year we're close together. It could be 5:30 a.m.
Hello!
What's happening, fellas?
How's it going?
Bill's fresh off. He's got nap head.
Nap jitsu.
Yes, this is true. I want to go take another. I may. If I'm not saying anything intelligent, it's because I'm sleeping in my head.
That's what it is.
Yeah, that's the problem.
That's right.
So what topics do we got today?
Well, some sad news. Lou Simpson, the great Lou Simpson, passed away yesterday. Vale Lou Simpson.
I was like almost certain you were going to say Bob Saget died.
Yeah, Bob Saget also died.
Is that right? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, man. Danny Tanner. No longer.
He wasn't that old.
65.
Nice, yeah.
Congestive heart failure.
Oh. Dude.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Evidently.
I don't actually know that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, that's probably like slandering the dead or something.
Yes. But he's got a good joke.
You know what was always wild to me was his persona from Full House versus his stand-up, which was like super raunchy.
Yeah. That was he had quite a stand-up persona.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a bummer. You guys just like ruined my day.
I know, man. It was sad.
Who's the third one? They always come in threes, don't they?
Yeah. Oh. Remains to be seen.
Okay.
I got a few interesting topics today.
Ooh, nice. You can carry me.
So I've been looking at, I started reading Dave Collum's Year in Review. It's such a massive tome. It's like a week long effort to get through it. It must take him a year to write. He must have to start.
Yeah.
Next year's right now. This year's right now. There's some interesting stuff. He's talking a little bit about commodities. I'm not talking about him on commodities. I've got Fundsmith on commodities, which is kind of interesting. Little Substack, I found Watchlist has this take on Buffett's analysis of Coke, which I thought was kind of interesting. And Drew Dixon at Albert Bridge. Thank you. Capital. He's done a little bit on value versus growth in a drawdown. So those are my three topics. JT, what you got?
Three, man. You are over delivering.
Yeah, I'm going to let you run with that, Toby.
Yeah, toss those out. We can chew on them.
I actually have two. So I guess we were all anticipating having to bring a little extra this week. My first one is on cytokine storms, which is a immune reaction that maybe we'll get into. And then, being the kind of towards the beginning of the year and a bit of a, you do a little review and soul searching. I did a kind of a post-mortem on why the hell didn't I own Google over the last 5 years? And so there's some numbers and like little back of the envelope math to unpack that might be useful or interesting.
I'm going to see what you guys have to say.
Okay.
Jake, do you want to?
I've been thinking about Bridgewater stuff. So if we don't get through, I may talk Bridgewater a little. I do think somebody was right. I'm almost certain where Ray said civil unrest and not civil war, but I don't know.
I just randomly saw a thread on it today, and I thought that he did in fact say civil war. Well, according to his
I thought he did, but I don't know. I didn't go back and re-listen to those. I got sent a different video, which I like quite a bit, from their CIO, did a podcast with Grant Williams in Endgame, and I thought that was pretty good talk.
An account I like, Random Walk, was just comparing Buffett's sort of sunny optimism with Dalio's sour of more dour assessment of the prospects of the US versus China. Dalio is a big China fan. Buffett's obviously a big backer of the big US optimist in general and optimist on the US. And I prefer Buffett's view of the world, but they definitely did say, in this thread, Dalio was like, chance of civil war reasonably high, higher than you might expect.
Yeah, I guess I just don't know. I need more definitions on war and whatnot. But yeah.
What counts as unrest?
You have to declare it.
Are we not already? Well,
is it like is it like a political war? I don't know. Obviously.
Storming the Capitol, does that count? People marching, does that count?
I don't know. I just, you know, there's sometimes when people say things that are outlandish, and I don't even know that he said that. I just think it should be the interviewer, and I've been an interviewer and I missed follow-ups, but like something like that warrants a follow-up.
Yeah.
What exactly are you saying here? So
yeah.
No. Let's just move on to your all-weather portfolio.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know that I would characterize him though as like a China lover, although that one answer people are gonna skewer me and be like, didn't you see what he said about that? But I just kind of wonder. I do kind of buy into the idea that, like, you know, the US got to set the rules for a while and now the rules are changing. And I'm not sure that we're actually hungry enough to navigate that change.
The American eater is always hungry, Bill.
That's true. But the American worker is very hard to find.
Ooh. Ouch.
Do you think that that's a stimulus as a result of the stimulus? That seems to be like the prevailing narrative, right?
No, I think for a long time, I don't know. I think America's, as a country, spends more than we earn and not as hungry as people that need it more. I don't think that's like controversial. Go try to find a bar back.
Maybe they need to pay more.
But you can't. So typically not done by Americans. I mean, a lot of jobs. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
I've been a bar back. That's all right.
I have too. I had a great time.
Yeah, so did I. It was fun.
A lot of non-monetary benefits.
JT, do you want to take it away? We'll let you kick it off today since I'm always relegating you to third place. This will let everybody close down early. You can turn it off as soon as JT's done.
Well, maybe I'll save my part two for the very end. But
we'll save do you want to save the side? Well, you know, no. It's up to
let's
you.
Let's do cytokine storms first. You know, last time we talked about E.O. Wilson and this idea of group selection over just purely gene selection. And it got me thinking about humanity as this sort of like super organism, which is something that Wilson espoused after looking at ants and seeing how they operate as this sort of super organism that seems coordinated at levels that don't make sense if you just look at their very, very simple biology. So let's, you know, the Spanish flu, 1918 to 1920, right? And it killed 40 million people. And a lot of those people were 20 to 40 year old healthy people, which is like shocking and scary, right? If you were actually living through it and, you know, a reasonably healthy person. As far as probably the life years lost and the quality of life years that were lost in that, it's like way different than COVID, right? Where it's, COVID sort of had a lot of more towards the older people that fell into it. But anyway, at that time, the global population was about 1.8 billion people. So 40 million on 1.8 billion, that's like 2.2% of the population. So if we had a similar equivalent of COVID today on a 7 billion population, that'd be 150 million people who would have died from COVID. Versus the roughly 5 million, I think was the last statistic that I saw. So like 5 versus 150, like dramatically different, right? So it's we got probably very lucky actually with the severity of COVID relative to what happened in the Spanish flu. And what was going on there was this, in why young people were hurt and killed by the Spanish flu, was that it created this thing called a cytokine storm. And cytokines are this immune response that are normally okay for your body to do. Like they circulate through your blood, but they cause inflammation and they help activate the immune system. But if they get to be too many of them in your blood, it will then impact your organs, and you actually, organs will shut down and people will die from that. So it's like going back then to Wilson and this idea of a super organism of the humanity, it has me wondering, if is it possible that COVID triggered a cytokine storm at a societal level? Like the super organism has this immune response to a pathogen. It's not biological as much as it actually is like a societal response. And so we're seeing all kinds of inflammation. We're seeing organ failure, like sort of like the trust in our institutions seems to be eroding. And a lot of this, my thoughts are like dovetail in with this podcast I listened to with Dr. Peter Attia that he did recently, kind of on a COVID update with these other two doctors, that was really good. I enjoyed it a lot. And he was lamenting that he felt like, you know, this, you know, COVID's been bad, but from a societal standpoint, like sort of the loss of trust might be the biggest casualty of the whole thing. And when we actually do need to coordinate again in the future for something that's worse, like if we actually had the Spanish flu, like people might be like, you know what, you kind of dicked me around this last time, I'm not going to listen to you this time. Right. And so it has me thinking like, all right, well, what can we do? What's the societal equivalent of trying to clear out the cytokines? So in treatment for a biological cytokine storm, they will give steroids to help reduce inflammation, and then do actually like dialysis to clear out the cytokines out of the bloodstream. So what's the dialysis that we could all be doing from a societal level to remove some of this inflammation and get back to, you know, kind of get back to a normal amount of trust and interaction and sort of belief in our systems? And you know, like for me, it sort of comes back to kind of controlling your own things, where, you know, go for a walk in nature, you know, like lower your stress levels, try to be kind to each other, and maybe practice the golden rule of treating people how you'd want to be treated. Humility probably on the part of our leadership would probably go a long way right now, I think. And that was actually one of the most troubling things about that Attia podcast, was some of the things they told about the NIH and the CDC were just like, I mean, level 10, oof, you know, just like really like, oh my God, that's pretty bad. So I probably shouldn't get into like the specifics. I don't understand them as well as probably a lot of other people do, but just the lack of transparency of what's supposed to be science-based and, you know, open book when you're trying to be scientific. Like that's a big part of the scientific method, is share the data, let other people look at it. They kind of have kept a lot of that stuff to themselves and ignored a lot of the other outside scientists they would normally advise. Like they shut them out and have just like stayed on their own sort of party line or company line. Anyway, I think it's kind of interesting to imagine the human species as a bigger superorganism, and maybe we're experiencing an immune response to a potential threat.
Yeah, I was, when it all first started happening, to be fair, I just spent a weekend with Chris Cole, and you know, Cole's like a tail hedging guy. So I'm always, you know, I think he's like one of the sentinels who's way out on the edge watching for things happening. And then we came straight back. I came back from that and I was sitting in the airport away from my family reading Zero Hedge on COVID.
Everything.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't even at that stage yet. He was just saying, here are all of these satellite shots of China where they'd like, they were burning things. They were burning things, and they were saying like they're burning all of these bodies. And they had all the pictures of people like falling over in the street. You remember that?
Yeah,
they were like welding people into their houses and stuff like that, which seemed pretty frightening. And I, And I have read books on the Spanish flu, which sort of followed World War One, was like came out of World War One. And so I was pretty nervous about that. You can go back and listen to those podcasts that we were recording around that time. I thought this is, as you're describing, like the Spanish flu was, you know, massively impactful to the working age people, and, you know, society was, you know, potentially could have collapsed at that point. And that's, societies collapse all the time. You go back through ancient history, like there's some scary stuff that happens when Carthage against the Romans, like the Romans defeated Carthage and then went and obliterated Carthage. Like there's no Phoenicians left anymore. There are lots of these things have just disappeared. So I was somewhat nervous that that was going to happen. Clearly none of that's happened. That was, as it's gone on, it seems, you know, not quite as aggressive as it may have first appeared.
But that, I mean, that was a bit of luck for humanity as well, right? Like it could have been that
bad. We didn't know. Like you should prepare for it as if it's going to be. Not that I think that there's much you can do to sort of avoid it, but, you know, prepare for it as if it is going to be that way. Get some food and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I have nothing to add.
Yeah, sorry. Someone commented the other day that we've criticized Spanish moss, Spanish flu. Lo siento, amigos. I don't mean to be, I'm not criticizing Spain. Someone's left a comment, Spanish flu is great branding. It came out of the US.
That's also a lie. Nothing bad comes out of the US except for Alabama football.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, wasn't it like came out of like Missouri or something and then went taken
it
over?
It was from
to
the
World
Spaniards. Everybody knows it.
What I mean,
it's a conspiracy that you're talking about, man.
What,
anyway,
what was the Spanish moss? What was
it's very invasive in Florida. It's very
okay.
You don't want that stuff on your trees.
We're beating
pretty,
up the Spaniards,
but it's invasive. I got love Spaniards. For Spain. I went to the Basque region, had some pinchos. That's not how they say it, but it's fucking good food. Really good food. They have these bars and you like walk around and you can get a bite of foie gras. It's like the best foie gras ever. That duck was tortured for me.
Yeah, poor old foie gras. That's what I did myself out
of Christmas. Goose. Wasn't it? I thought it was goose liver. Isn't that foie gras?
Probably, yeah.
Whatever it was, I'm glad that it had a terrible life because I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I do that to myself over in the silly season between Christmas and New Year's. I turn my liver into foie gras.
Like a stuffed goose.
I mean, I don't know, on the COVID stuff, I'm just glad I'm in Florida, man.
Mm. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I if you didn't tell me COVID was going on right now, I would have no idea.
Really? No, yeah. There's nobody's wearing masks or anything?
Very few people.
Interesting.
We're all outside all day.
That's fair.
I'm worried about my kids' school, you know, but like they survived Delta and they'll survive this. And I don't know, man, it's time to get back to it, in my opinion. But I'm also not at risk of death at the moment. And I was scared during Delta. So we'll see.
Kind of think live and let live
is a pretty good philosophy at this point, given all the data.
There's definitely a panic going on here in California. There's a lot more. I've noticed a lot more of the N95 mask where people were sort of rolling around with the, you know, just
California's
the temporary
ones. California's nuts, man. Y'all are out of your fucking minds.
Well, not all of us, but most of us are, yeah.
Yeah.
Collectively.
JT, do you want to do Google or do you want me to let me just this little Coke? There's really nothing to this little Coke analysis. I just thought it was interesting. It'll take me 2 seconds and then do Google. But watchlist investing is this Substack. They just reminded me of the great analysis that Buffett did on Coke was basically this: as long as the unit sales of Coke are going up and the share count of Coke is going down, Buffett's analysis was this will probably work out, you know, given that it was like, it looked like he was paying more than he had ever paid in the past, but they hadn't done any of the international expansion that, you know, we now know has been so successful. I just thought it's one of those really elegant, you know, typical Buffett, boil it down to like two kind of moving parts, make sure they're going in the right direction and just, you know, just let it happen. which
Swedish
clear,
match
that worked out okay.
Charter.
Swedish match.
Yeah. Sell more nicotine pouches, retire shares.
Yeah, that works.
It's, you know, working.
It reminds me of the Zeckhauser. There's a book that that somebody wrote of all of his analytical maxims. And, you know, Zeckhauser was this professor at Harvard who was an economist, but he was also like a world-class bridge player. And Buffett and Munger were friends with him. And one of the things that is in that book is that, like, good analysis typically requires a denominator. So you're always trying to, like, figure out, like, per unit, that those per something, and that you could see it in Buffett's, like, when he talks about things and he says, like, you know, every whatever 8-ounce serving of Coke is, you know, 1/8 of it is goes to Berkshire, basically. Like, he does these little interesting kind of per unit calculations all the time, and it's really smart. But I think that's where he got it from, with Zeckhauser.
Yeah, it's a good approach. Do you want to do Google? I just wanted to sort of mention it because I thought it was just an elegant little solve, and I just wanted to sort of start using it myself. So I thought it was a good approach.
The other thing that's nice about Charter, even though, you know, it's a cable company and people hate them, is then they use, at least my perception of their strategy, although Comcast pricing is not that much different, but, you know, they use their scale advantage locally to drive prices down, which makes overbuilding less enticing. It's a nice sleep at night stock. Until rates go up and they can't refi their debt, I'm in a poor house.
It's a zero.
It's a question here. Is Zeckhauser the unknown and unknowable guy?
Wasn't that...
Sorry, folks.
Dick Cheney.
Your phone, Rooster. Jeez.
Donald Rumsfeld, right?
Or Rumsfeld, that's what I meant. Sorry,
but did somebody didn't you gave a you, one of your veggies was on the different quadrants, right?
Oh yeah, no, I don't think that was him. I know which one you're saying, but I don't remember.
Let's do Google. Yeah, why didn't we all just buy Google and go to the beach? We could. I think it's reasonable. I've heard people buying it now. I haven't closely looked, but if you. You know, you don't like it.
We'll get to that too. But all right, so this comes from when I look at Google and I say, like, okay, why haven't I owned it for the last 5 or 6 years? And I've been to the campus multiple times. I know lots of smart people that work there. I'm very impressed by the culture more generally. Read a couple books about it. Recognize that search and the ad sales from search is easily one of the best businesses to ever spawn on planet Earth. Like, it's incredible. Knowing all of that, how did I miss it? And, like, really trying to rub my nose in this mistake, because this is like, this is one of those big opportunity cost loss that really hurts. So it's good to unpack it. So in this process, I tried to take put myself and transplant myself back to 2015, and then just look at all of the numbers, the financials from like, say, 2010 to 2015, and just sort of like get a sense of what would I have paid in 2015. And if I looked forward another 5 or 6 years of what I thought the business might do, what would have been a reasonable expected return, and then what actually happened. So I'm going to walk through the numbers, and I might move kind of quick, but I should probably like put this together into a tweet storm or something so that the numbers are a little bit more easy to follow along. But so in Google's income statement from 2010 to 2015, revenue grew from $24 billion to $66 billion. So we have a 22% annual growth on revenue top line for those 5 years. Okay. Operating margin in 2010 was 35%. That went down to 25% in 2015. I don't know if this is like moonshots or whatever the hell was pinching the operating margin, but margin was trending down. And then you had the 2015 valuation, the EV to EBIT was 19 times. And the average EV to EBIT over that 2010 to 2015 period was 17 times. So it was roughly trading kind of where it typically traded in 2015, if I was to consider buying it. So you had a market cap of about $360 billion, and an EV, the cash balance was had started out at 24 billion in 2010 and then gone to 63 billion. So the cash balance actually was on a 20% CAGR as well. And so backing the cash out, you had an EV of 307 billion in 2015. Okay, so let's start from there. And then I'm going to make projections to the year 2021. Like, what would I have expected this business to do? So I assumed 15% CAGR, which, you know, it was 22%, I said previously, but, you know, a company that big, if you look at the base rate book that Malbosan put out, you would say, boy, there has to be something really special going on here to ever imagine that you could keep compounding at that level. So I'm just going to like back it off. I'm not going to say it's like dying, but I'm going to back it off somewhat. Okay, so 15% CAGR. That would make then revenue growing from 66 billion in 2015 to 152 billion in 2021. All right, I'm going to assume operating margin falls to 20%, which remember it had gone 35, 25. I'm going to assume it kind of found a reasonable level of 20%. So that would then make earnings grow from 17 billion to 30 billion from 2015 to 2021. And then I'm going to stick a 20 EV to EBIT multiple on that. And like I said, it was 17 for that average of 2010 to 2015. So I'm kind of already like imagining a pretty good exit multiple at that 2021, I think. And so you end up with an EV of about 600 billion, right? And so grow that cash balance again by 15% CAGR. So then back into a market cap of 455 billion then is what I would have come up with as my projection of the market cap in 2021. So 360 in 2015, that was known, my projection's 455 in 6 years. That's a 4% CAGR. Okay. Like that's not like that amazing. And I thought I gave them reasonable credit. I gave them a 15% top line growth. I gave them a 20% multiple or a 20% or 20 times multiple, 20% margin. Like these are all pretty healthy assumptions, I think. Like I'm not like going crazy. Well, what actually ended up happening? Okay. Revenue grew to 182 billion, which was an 18% CAGR. So the revenue growth rate slowed down a little bit. I gave them 15, they came in at 18. All right, like not that far off. Operating margin came in at 23%. I gave them 20. All right, we're not that far off there. So you get then an EBIT of 42. Here's where the thing where it went sideways for me. Multiple went to 31 times EV to EBIT. I was giving them credit for 20. Okay, so I was off by quite a bit. So that comes in at 1.3 trillion for the EV then at that point. Back out 137 billion of cash. And you end up with a market cap then of basically like 1.1 trillion in 2021. So share count basically stayed flat. Like they retired whatever they were bought, whatever they issued in stock options to all my friends that work there. So you ended up then the market cap going from 360 in 2015 to 1.1 trillion in those 6 years, which is a 22% CAGR that I missed. So my projections, what I thought were reasonable, came out with a 4%. Potential CAGR, and it ended up coming in at 22%. And basically, like I was a little too pessimistic on top line and I was a little pessimistic on margin, but I was way too pessimistic on what everyone else was willing to pay for it at 20 versus 31.
So is the analysis that you didn't make a mistake because on the analysis that you, on the facts that you, on the assumption that you made at the time, it was the right decision?
I would say that my
all sort of false humility aside.
Yeah, my down the middle like base of what I imagined the business would do was probably a little pessimistic, and even looking at it today, so like it was a little bit more right taily of an outcome, which you maybe should have expected with such a great business and so many smart people working there and so many ways to win. Here's where it gets insane. In the last 9 months. So trailing 12 months from the last report, which was 9/30/21, revenue has grown to 239 billion, which is a 44% CAGR over the last 9 months.
Whoa.
Operating margin jumped to 30% from 23.
Whoa.
Yeah. So EBIT 72 billion, which is 105% CAGR over a year.
Whoa.
And then, so the multiple actually came down a little bit from 31 to 25 EV to EBIT, but you still end up with a 77% CAGR in the EV over the last 9 months. So like this thing just went absolutely, I mean, it's insane.
Why did it take off? Is it a lockdown thing or is it, what is it?
Dude, I think it's, I think it's lockdown, everyone on the internet all day long now. I don't know. I mean, Bill, you probably have a better idea why.
YouTube?
Yeah, maybe.
I think they reined in some spending. Buybacks started to become a priority. Get some more e-commerce, more advertising, travel advertising starts to come back. I don't know exactly all the reasons for the inflection up, but I think if you just hang like a 75% tax rate on a 20% EBIT or 20 times EBIT multiple, you're at like 26 times. I don't know. I think the ROIC probably requires slightly higher multiples for this business. I mean,
especially if they're doing buybacks, right? Instead of like moonshots that don't ever materialize.
What?
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, and then they got GCP starts to show some flash, and I don't know, you start to get some religion on what actually matters from spend, and you get a CEO change, that guy gets focused on some things. I mean, I bought it when the CEO turned, like I increased my position when the CEO was named, and actually I thought it was less of two people's pet project and closer to a business that was going to be run for public shareholders.
Good man.
Good comment here from Dylan Thompson saying Google going to rein in headcount expenses like Bezos to Amazon back in 2018. I tend to agree with that. I did a deal with them when I was a general counsel of a telecommunications company in Australia, and we were just astonished at the amount of money that they spent. Like they all flew first class.
Oh yeah.
As a shareholder, I don't know that I really want that, to be honest. Mm.
But they have that lever to pull at some point. It doesn't have to be now, but if they ever look like they're going to miss numbers, hey, everybody, you got to fly business class now.
I mean, YouTube is a fucking monster, man. My kids don't even watch TV anymore. Like, I don't know, like thinking like really long and stuff, like IP that's tied to the bundle. Like my kids just watch. I mean, I guess Viacom bought Ryan or the rights to Ryan or whatever.
Oh, the kid who does the unboxing?
Yeah, well, he had like Ryan's Playhouse or whatever, but like my kids watch stuff like the Fun Squad and just these families that pimp their families out. My kids love that stuff.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
Kids like to watch other people play video games and then yell over the top of them while they're playing the video games. It's so annoying to listen to.
I mean, the other thing is like, you know, I was doing Google, just they have a lot of stuff that's like working in a big way. Like I was doing Roku research and asked some of my international peeps, like, how do you guys watch TV? And the amount of people that are watching on Android stuff, I think, you know, as a US focused person is easy to miss. And then like, once you think global, Google's a monster.
Do you guys want to try walking forward 5 years from here to see what might look like?
Just before you do, there's a good comment from Wolfflow. They took away the dislike button, so there's nothing not to like. That's a good one.
Well, I see dislike on ours right here.
Are you? But they don't count them. They just sort of you mash that button. It's just for you.
Smash that dislike button.
It's a bad idea. I'll do it, and I'll come back with an actual, not off the top of my head answer.
You've done some analysis, JT?
Yeah, of course. We'll try to walk through the same exercise, but from today, looking forward, what might it look like? So let's assume, first of all, that like trailing 12 months from 931 is close enough to call that 2021, and we'll just like work forward from there. Let's assume revenue grows at 15% CAGR for the next 5 years. It was 18 the previous 5 years, but they just had this monster 44%.
Still haven't learned your lesson, JT.
I know. Fuck. Someday there's going to be some reversion to the mean where you can't just grow to the sky. Well, you just put up 44% last year. Like you would think that maybe that was pulled forward a little bit.
I'm not all criticizing. Right. How often are you going to be? How often are you going to be too pessimistic on your assessments? Like, not very often.
All the time, apparently. So revenue then at 15% CAGR grows from 239 today to 480 in 2026. Okay, let's give them an operating margin of 25%. Like I said, 30% this year, but let's just say that there is some drift downwards there. Like, it's tough to run a business and be that profitable all the time, but they continue to do it. So that gives you earnings growing from 72 billion today to 120 in 2026. Okay. Let's give them a 25x EV to EBIT. They've averaged 24 and a half over the last 5 years. We're paying up at the end of this terminal value. All right. So that gives you an EV of 3 trillion. Okay.
Modest.
Yeah. 3 trillion is a big business. We're going to assume the cash balance of today grows at a 10% clip, which matches the last 5 years. So that's going from 142 billion to 234 billion. So we'll back that out to give us a market cap of 2.7 trillion, let's call it. All right. So going from today, 1.8 to 2.7 in the next 5 years, that's an 8.8 CAGR over the next 5 years if they can deliver those results and that's what people are willing to pay for it. Well, and let's then also assume another 2% share count reduction, if they're buying back shares, which looks to be what they're starting to do. So even with very optimistic assumptions, I think, maybe I'm wrong again here as always, but 15% revenue growth rate, 25% operating margin, 25 times EV to EBIT, you only get about a 10% expected return from here, which, I mean, 10% is okay, but like there's still some level of execution risk baked into getting to that 3 trillion. I put together a little bit more of a bearish scenario, let's call it. Is it because maybe I'm wired that way, but let's just assume that they grow 5% revenue growth rate off of a huge base.
No way.
Huge base.
No
already.
Way.
He's doing a pessimist.
It's not realistic, analysis. In my opinion.
All right. Well, let's just humor me for 2 seconds. All right. That gets you to about 300 billion in revenue in 2026. All right. And by the way, like,
is this real or is this nominal?
Does it matter?
That's
I mean, if we're going to say inflation is like
5% is inflation. No, that's right.
Yeah. Like,
all right. Fair enough. Call it real. But let me remind you though, that 2019 revenue was 160 billion. So we're 2x-ing revenue from 2019. Okay. Like, this isn't insane.
There was a big change from 2020 till now.
I know.
Like,
exactly.
The world did change.
That is true. All right. Let's shrink operating margins to 20%. They were 22% in 2019. So this isn't like unprecedented. That actually changes earnings of 72 billion today to 61 billion in 2026, right? Because they've just been like so blow it out for the last year. Let's give them a 15 times EBIT. EV to EBIT, which was the average from 2010 to 2014. So again, not unprecedented. That gives you an EV of 915 billion. Okay. Let's assume that the cash balance stays at 142. And then we're doing pessimistic and we're going to say that they kind of piss away some of the money. They don't do buybacks. It's all moonshots and first class tickets. So that gives you then a market cap of 773 billion, that's a negative 15% CAGR from today to 2026, if that's what happens. So like, I don't think these are crazy pessimistic assumptions to have 5% revenue growth, 20% operating margin, 15 times EV to EBIT, and you end up with a negative 15% CAGR from here.
It's not going to happen.
Well, I'm not saying this is a likely scenario, but I don't think it's a 0% chance. Do you?
I think that plucking 5% out of the air is not... Yeah, I think it's very, very low probability scenario. Yes, I do.
You could be right. I'm not saying that you're wrong there, but you're trying to wrap your mind around the potential things that could happen.
I understand, but like to the upside, you got Waymo there. Like, that's not nothing. You got GCP there. That's not nothing. You got a continued structural move to digital advertising. You got the world going more mobile. Like, man, 5% is tough for me to buy. Fair enough. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I don't think it's probable. Well, which you don't either, to be fair. You're saying it's a bear case, but
yeah, I would say that you really cannot believe it if you're going to be long from here.
I do not.
That's fair.
Bill Nygren's been pretty good on this on Google for a long time. Oakmark's had a holding in it. His analysis has been basically the problem is the accounting rules, the treatment of other bets, expensing other bets when they capitalize other bets and they do a few other things. And basically they say you're getting Google's search business for less than an S&P 500 multiple once you sort of back everything else out.
I think with a lot of these tech companies, I haven't quite fully figured out how I like to do it, but I almost think of like shifting the income statement where like 2020's expenses should actually be comped to like 2021 or 2022 revenues. If that makes sense. Cause they're like, they're spending so far ahead of when the revenues come in that if you're looking at the margin, it's like artificially compressed relative to how like what reality is. I mean, the thing that is crazy to me is like, even with that growth, like I'm just looking at 2020, right? But you $65 million of cash flow provided by operations, despite that kind of growth. Like, that's fucking crazy.
It's a
your typical business, like working capital ends up like, you know, taking some money and like, you know, growth is not cheap. And these guys are just like showering themselves in cash while they grow. It's insane. So, but I mean, the buybacks really ramped up. That I think got the market excited.
Is it net? Are they net buybacks or are they just mopping up all of the option issuance?
No, it crossed over like, 2017-ish, actually. They stopped. It kind of peaked in 2018, and it's been starting to tip over and trend downward as total share count.
They need to lever up and bro down.
That's the Apple playbook.
Yeah, we got them to $3 trillion. Remember when $1 trillion was a lot? When did the first company hit $1 trillion? That was only a few years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, just looking, and my data feed might suck, but just like looking at consensus, 80 billion of free cash flow in 2022 on 1.7 billion EV. I mean, you're like a 4% free cash flow yield a year and a half out. That's like, it's not that rich.
Question from it's Annabelle not. Miller.
What do you think you fade it to?
Hold on. This is a credible, this is an interesting question. Annabelle Miller says, isn't the Web 3.0 premise that Web 2.0 ad-driven business models are defunct? What is Web 3.0?
Well, my understanding of some of the goal of Web 3.0 is to distribute some of the economics back to the people and away from those companies. I don't give a shit what the premise of it is. Like, we are not even close, in my opinion, to like proving that it's going to be a mainstream concept. And I kind of view a lot of, I mean, I say like I'm crypto curious. I say I'm interested in these NFTs. I've also said like I am curious for the same reason that I should have been curious about the internet in 1999. I mean, I think these could be like 20 or 30 years away. And the idea that like, I don't know. I don't know how it's all going to evolve. I got to think Google has some sense of how it might evolve. I also think it's interesting that Web 3.0, I guess there's different nodes it'll all run on, so it may not need GCP.
I did see a funny tweet that said Web 4.0 is just going outside.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a risk. I think like Preston Pish sent me some stuff through, I forget what the wallet was, but I think I talked about that when he sent me Bitcoin over a wallet. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. I mean, when you think of international remittances, when you think of like, you know, the banking or the rails and whatnot, you know, I don't know how it all, I don't know how the back end tech works. I have a hard enough time following the company as I own.
With the possibility for Web 3.0, this like distributed, you know, approach, how do you feel about something like Facebook's metaverse? Is that, are they trying to like AOL walled garden, just going at the wrong direction?
I think it's like something, my perception of what Zuckerberg sees is the next iteration of social. And I think the error that people make dismissing the metaverse is they see the numbers and it's a flashy, like it's obviously a marketing ploy, like what it's called and whatever. And then people are like, well, it's not getting adopted today, therefore this is stupid. But like, I mean, I agree Oculus has a long way to go. Like, I'm not sitting here saying, oh, it's tomorrow, we're all going to like plug in. But to sit around and hang out, and like I totally, if there was a world where my friends from Auburn and I all had some sort of AR or VR, well, this would be VR glasses, and we could have watched like the Alabama Georgia game together, like together, I would totally do that stuff. And I think that's kind of what like Zuckerberg sees. And then I think that it's very real when you apply it to business.
Why can't you just put the game on at your house and like open up a Zoom pointing
at
you?
Well, because it's two dimensional and not three dimensional. I mean, there is an element of feeling that's different when you watch through the Oculus that's sensory. I mean, it's why people get motion sick.
Nausea. Is that the feeling?
Yeah. Well, some people, yeah. I mean, it's a very cool idea. And I think if you're Zuck and you're looking at like how much cash this business is printing, I mean, I don't know, it does seem like a logical place that the world could go. So to just like not invest in it seems like death to me. Like that sounds crazy. At a minimum, I got to think he's going to get some advertising insights from all the R&D he's doing. And if that can take him into the next 20 years, then this thing's a home run. Even if it's maybe not NPV positive. It's like milk. Right? Like maybe it's just the loss leader.
Zuckerberg is cookie licking by naming FB Meta, trying to scare the other kids away. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I mean, my boy Francisco thinks Roblox is like the best metaverse play.
Your boyfriend, Cisco?
Yeah, that's right. Oh. And I think, you know, he's got a pretty compelling argument. It's a damn good business model, at least it appears to be.
Toby, do you have more? I thought you had a couple extra items we need.
I got some bits and pieces. Throw your questions in, guys. These aren't particularly, nothing's particularly big here. I was just kind of throwing them out. So Terry Funsmith talking about commodities, because I read Dave
Terry
Collins.
Smith.
Yeah, change Sorry, his name to Funsmith.
Did I say Terry Funsmith?
Terry McFunsmith.
Yes, Terrence McFunsmith.
Like Tim Apple.
Tim Apple.
Just so everyone knows who I'm talking about.
Warren Berkshire.
After reading Dave Collins, you know, Dave's written a little bit about commodities and how, you know, commodities have basically not participated in the last sort of 13 years or 14 years, whatever it is. And that you can find all those charts that show there's extreme sort of disparities between, you know, the equities versus commodities, pick your commodity. We're at a wider spread than we were in 1999. Whether that's meaningful or not, I have no idea, because it's, you know, the natural state of commodities has tended to be, I think, it's deflation because we get better at pulling stuff out of the ground. Having said that, we're doing more increasingly heroic things to pull energy out of the ground. So maybe that does get harder and harder to do. And there's a lot of facts and figures in his little article. So I was just sort of interested in this little thing from Terry Funsmith, where Terry Smith at Funsmith, it is a great name for a fund, by the way, or for a firm. He said that the first order of commodity prices kicking off isn't felt by consumers. It's felt by, because they tend to be their first order goods consumed by producers or consumed by manufacturers, consumed by businesses. And so they impact business profitability before they impact consumers. But the way that they might show up is like some increase in the discount rate. So, you know, a high quality company's definitionally has something, has very high margins and can control its margins. And if its input costs go up, depending on what portion of those margins the input costs consume, that's how much you impact the profitability. Maybe that increase in the cost cuts the margins, warrants an increase in the discount rate. So you see some of these companies that are intensive consumers of commodities being impacted. I don't know if you then necessarily want to go and get long a whole of these commodity players. They're just, they haven't been particularly good. Like, you know, gold does look interesting. Energy's been running. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think that you said that high quality companies have high margins, and there's one amendment. They can have high turnover and low margins, right? That's a, that's another way that you could run that. Like Costco, for instance, but I agree that they have pricing power. I do not, I talked to Will Thompson. Will runs Massive Capital, and I interviewed him. It's coming out, I think, in 2 weeks. And he said something that I think is really right. And I think it's been somewhat similar when I pitched banks in the past, like big banks. Although Wells, I actually do think was an asset-specific thesis. When you get generalists that are pitching big commodity companies, it's basically a macro bet.
Yeah.
And that rarely goes well. And I think it's interesting that a lot of people right now that I see just in the chatter and whatever are like, commodities are cheap and everything else is expensive. But then they, it seems to me that they're projecting, at least some of these people are projecting that we're in an everything bubble. And my question is, if the everything bubble pops, it would tend to suggest to me that commodities would go down, like commodity quantity demanded would go down. And if the quantity demanded of a commodity goes down, the operating leverage bucks you hard. And that is like a technical term. And I think that maybe
CFA level three.
Yeah. Like then they're not so cheap. Right. On the other hand, see what's going on with lumber. And it's like, man, this, you know, if this sticks, oh my. So I don't know.
I see
Mike Mitchell's been in the comments. There you go, Mike. We finally got into lumber.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's really, I understand why people like commodities right now. I just also, I don't know, man. Cheap cyclicals, generalist pitching commodities, generalist pitching big banks. It's, I'm not sure how the base rates work on that.
JT?
Hard to unpack. There's a lot of moving pieces to all of this, right? Like, I think it's pretty safe to say, I think that, and like Einhorn has observed this, that the capital that's gone into those industries has really been shut off and pinched off. And
yeah,
we've probably, there's been a lot more capital, a lot more interest going into software projects than there has drilling for oil or, you know, or iron ore or something. So I don't know. Like, I think these things all move in cycles and eventually there's some reversion to the mean on all of them. I don't know how long that takes. I don't really care of what generalists are saying or doing, or I don't use, I wouldn't try to use that as a measuring stick for much. Like that's like that's basically like Mr. Market adjacent, like, but I don't know. I think there's long term, very long term, I'm, you know, I think that commodities, long commodities is short human ingenuity, and I wouldn't really want to be short human ingenuity for a long time.
I guess what I would say about the generalist comment that I made is like, if you listen to Mike talk about lumber, I think that's how good you have to be in commodities. Like, it's not a game to just, in my opinion, look at and be like, yeah. Now, that said,
which investment space is the right where you should just have a kind of half-assed understanding and just be
punting. I mean, there's none. I guess my personal problem with the commodity thesis is the amount of time that I'm going to sink into learning about it. I don't view it as particularly transferable in the future. And as someone that is like just trying to figure out how to leverage time better, because I have like none of it right now, it's just not really where I'm going to spend my time. And if I have an aversion, that's probably the actual answer as to why. I do think that like if these EVs, like we'll cite some stats on how much it's going to take, like how many years of lithium production we need in order to actually go to EV. It's insanity. Like, we just fundamentally don't have it. The other thing that I think is somewhat funny is everybody that's talking about climate change and hailing EVs as the solution, like dig a bunch of holes in the ground, fill them with like acidic runoff, take all these natural resources out of the ground and put them in batteries. Like, we're going to have a different climate problem. It may be like a resource allocation issue or whatever, but I think there's maybe some unforeseen second order effects from all this rah-rah that people may wake up and say, oh, well, the devil we knew was better than the one we ran to, but
you always time
will
ask,
tell on that.
And then what?
Yeah.
What we need is an asteroid that we can harness that has all of these rare earth minerals in it and land that thing.
Maybe it'll land all by itself.
Yeah.
Maybe something will fling out of the Kuiper belt and get us. Maybe it'll come in at too high a speed. Yeah, somebody mentioned before that Bill Miller, who's sort of in the process of stepping down, and like last year or the year before, I think he said he'd become a billionaire. And this year, or recently, he said that 50% of his net worth is Bitcoin.
Yeah, dude, he's been pitching Bitcoin since like 2015. He's got that Preston Pish money.
And the other 70% is Amazon.
Yeah. Is that how math works? Yeah.
Well,
I think that's right.
If you're levered up.
I saw a question before about small cap value versus value generally. It's tough because I you know, spend a lot of time in mid and large and small. The smalls are, I don't know if this is always the case, but the smalls are definitely not as high quality as mid and larger. And the smalls traded a big discount to mid and large. So the question is the discount to mid, is the discount to the smalls, or is the multiple low enough to justify the discount that, you know, the lower quality that you're getting from small? I don't know. It's hard to, I honestly don't know. I sort of, my feeling, and I know that this is completely counterintuitive, I sort of feel like mid and large value is a slightly better place to be than small value, even though it is a little bit more expensive. That might be complete heresy. It might be 100% driven by multiples, but
well, so the small value is the only style box right now that's below its 20-year average PE. All the other ones are above their 20-year average.
Yeah, that I've seen that I think I talked about that a few months ago, where that you know, the bottom, if you can visualize that style box with the nine things, and on one axis is the size, and on the other axis is like value to growth. The bottom left-hand corner, which is small value, is the only one. It's at like, what did you say, 95% of its long run mean?
Yeah, it's not like it's insanely cheap relative to its long run, but it's the only one below.
Yeah, I think you run up, if you go up that left-hand column, which is all the value stuff, I think large value is at like 105%, and I think mid value is at like 101%, and then going out to like the top right-hand corner is like 165% or something of its long run mean. Oh, sorry, whatever that large growth is at 165% of its long run mean. I don't know. It's hard to, I personally have a lot of difficulty working out which one's going to outperform, because they are at a discount, but they are
better also.
Well, the smalls are worse. And I don't know if this is like a product of, I think I said Sarbox last time, Sarbanes-Oxley. just makes it harder to, you know, it's like $1 million more expensive, or it was last time I looked, $1 million more expensive to get listed as a result of Sarbanes-Oxley than it had been before then. And so what companies tended to do was to stay private for longer, you know, like Facebook, where previously that might've come out public as a small, you know, they just wait until they're mammoth before they list. So they go have a chance of hitting the index pretty quickly, the big index. I don't know is the answer, but I have a slight feeling that it's going to be, maybe it's going to be mid's where you want to be.
Yeah. Trade-offs.
I have nothing to add.
Drew Dixon, this Albert Bridge, I tweeted this out last week. Drew Dixon had this little take on what happens in the next big drawdown, because, you know, if you, growth seems to be expensive, but growth's been so beaten up over the last, I guess since February 12 last year was the date. So we're coming up on a year of growth being beaten up. Value's had a little bit of a run, but still the spreads is, I honestly don't know how these aggregated numbers are working out, but the aggregated numbers are still saying the spread is as wide as it's ever been. And value's sort of been, value ran to like May last year, and it's been losing ground to the index ever since, losing ground. None of the aggregated figures match what my like intuitive narrative would say is going on. So I honestly don't know. Just trying to buy cheap stuff that's flowing cash and buying back stock and not worrying about it too much at this point. Just kind of hoping that it all works out.
Yeah. Bottom up.
Bottom
folks.
Up.
Bottom up, folks.
Yeah. So my long rambling answer is bottom up.
Well, I don't know. Jerry Capp came out on Avalara or whatever. And I think that ideas like that, not necessarily that idea. But I could get down with buying smaller companies that have like a very, very long growth runway and high structural margins. Like that I could get down with. Obviously the nuances all matter. But
is it time to start picking through the growth wreckage yet?
I kind of think so. My gut says growth rallies.
Hmm. Yeah, there's some stuff that's expensive. Like I'm amazed that when I look at Kathy's portfolio, as much as it's down, I look in there and I'm like, there's some crazy kind of valuations in here.
I mean, Roku, I just haven't quite gotten to, but that's one that I've been looking at and thinking about for a while. I don't know.
Somebody sent me a chart that showed, you know, not the hype cycle, the other one where this is not the hype cycle. It's something else. And they just overlaid ARC over the, I haven't shared it because I don't have the source yet. I've asked for the source and the permission to share, but when I get it, I'll send it out. But basically it, you know, when we have the kind of the bubble run, like the tulip kind of pathway, there's this run up to a huge peak and then it pulls back. And then there are the dip buyers who come in pretty close to the top. And they dip by and there's a little rally and that's when you get the final flush. And basically the two charts over the top, it's kind of spooky how close those two charts are. Now, I know that laying one chart over the other is just complete bullshit analysis, but it's an amazingly good fit. That was my comment. So it's funny. If I get, I'll get some permission to share it and I'll tweet it out. It's interesting.
Oh, I gotta follow up on Expel. I said that I would work through Expel on Value After Hours in real time. So here's where my work is at. I have done some surveys of some of my friend group. I need to have a more diverse data set. I remain pretty concerned about the total addressable market here. And at the end of the day, I'm just not sure that I'm going to buy how big it can grow into, but I am remaining open and trying to disprove confirmation bias. So talked to the Mercedes dealer today, and they said that they rarely install it on anything, but the Porsche dealer installs it on a lot. So I thought it was kind of interesting that a Mercedes dealer is rarely installing it, but potentially Mercedes owners don't love their cars. That's possible.
It's time, amigos.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, JT, you got something to add?
Oh, I just I talked to actually the local Mercedes dealer in this area, and something like 80% of the cars are just leased. So if you're leasing,
yeah, a leased car,
you're not going to wrap a leased car, right?
Unless they can tell you we're going to hit you so hard on the paint when you bring it back that it makes sense. But I tend to agree with you. So then I go to like, all right, even if your front's $2,000, like how expensive does your car actually need to be? And my gut tells me $50,000 and higher.
Yeah.
And it probably needs to be a dark paint.
More, right?
What?
It's more of a vanity thing too, isn't it?
I tend to agree with you, yes, which is why I have a hard time trusting the growth.
We're over time, amigos. This was fun.